This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Tortoise. Hello, I'm Giles Whittell. I'm Tortoise's deputy editor. It's the week ending Friday, the 19th of April. From Tortoise, welcome to the news meeting.
This story is absolutely extraordinary. Suspended Conservative MP Mark Menzies stands accused of, all manner of misdemeanours and misbehaviours.
India's mammoth election season has kicked off. Almost a billion voters will cast their franchise over the next 44 days to elect its government.
So much rain in such a dry country has led to speculation that it was caused by cloud seeding.
Nigel Farage and Conservative politicians from across Europe find themselves on the wrong side of the police in Brussels.
Have you seen the people in the room? Do this look like a bunch of yobs to you? Far, far from it.
So the question is, what makes a lead story? To help me work that out, I'm joined by Tortoise's political editor, Kat Neelan, and climate editor, Jeevan Vasagar. Hello, both of you.
Hello.
Hi, Charles.
And we are delighted to welcome Cristiana Figueres, who was the UN's climate chief, and my notes say one of the architects, I would say the architect, of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Cristiana, you're shaking your head.
I'm already shaking
Tell
my
us what.
Head. Well, because so many people participated in that. So there are thousands and thousands. Actually, thousands of people should put, "I delivered the Paris Agreement" on their CV. And that would be accurate.
And maybe it would be good for maintaining momentum for the goals outlined there. It's an interesting idea. Anyway, Cristiana, you are also host of the weekly climate change podcast, Outrage and Optimism. Tell us, first of all, Cristiana, when is the next episode of your podcast out?
We release every Thursday. So we come out every Thursday.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, we record usually on Tuesdays and we drop every Thursday. It's quite an exhausting exercise, but we have a lot of fun. The three of us on three co-hosts, we have a lot of fun because we try to bring information about climate writ large. It's not a nerdy program. It really is about what is happening on the climate space, but from many different perspectives. And we do it with a lot of humor because, honestly, otherwise you wouldn't be able to digest the news on climate.
Okay, it's Outrage and Optimism wherever you get your podcasts. And I should say, you are joining us from Costa Rica, is that right?
Yes. I am Costa Rican, I was born and raised here, at least until I was 16. Then I left and lived in many other countries. And I am so fortunate that the pandemic brought me back home. So I'm speaking to you from home.
Okay. You've each got a story that you think should lead the news. So let's begin with long story short. This is where in a headline or a sentence, you tell us what you want to pitch. Jeevan, why don't you go first?
Charles, my long story short is ashes to ashes. I'm not sure how good a headline it is, but I can't resist a Barry lyric.
We'll find out. Okay. Kat, what's yours?
Mine is bad people and drunk dogs.
Bad people and drunk dogs. Cristiana, I should warn you that there's a certain, and I don't want to give anything away, my response away, but there's a certain parochial nature to some of the other stories here. But tell us your long story short.
My long story short is climate change comes home to bite in the UAE.
Right. Okay. Jeevan, let's start with yours. I think you're talking about a ban on smoking. Am I right?
That's right. So this week, Giles, a ban on anyone who was born after the 1st of January 2009 buying tobacco products has taken a step closer to becoming law in the UK. This would be an unprecedented ban. There was a similar law in New Zealand that was revoked under the current government in New Zealand. So the UK might be the only country in the world where this happens.
And I think there are two interesting things about this. One is that it's a pet project of Rishi Sunak's, is it not? And he is clearly persuaded of the overriding public health benefits. But also he's leader of a party that likes to condemn any hint of nanny statism. How has he got enough support to get it through the second reading?
So, as I understand, there was a significant Tory rebellion against this measure. Nearly 60 Tory MPs voted against and about 100 abstained. It was also criticised by two former Conservative prime ministers. So Liz Truss voted against it. Boris Johnson, who's not an MP anymore, described it as nuts. I think there are two or perhaps three really interesting things about this. The first is that obviously smoking is a huge public health harm. Measures that persuade people to stop smoking, give up smoking, are clearly very good from that point of view. But it raises a really interesting question, I think, about personal freedom. And as you said, you know, this may be the legacy of a Conservative prime minister, but as a party, they're clearly very divided over the idea of what the state's role should be, whether the state should legislate to stop people from committing acts of harm really against their own bodies. And I think kind of one really sort of odd thing about this law is that it basically kind of creates two groups of adults. So those who are, you know, those who are sort of born after 2009 will have different rights from those who were born after 2008. You might have perhaps 25-year-olds gathering outside newsagents asking 26-year-olds to go in and buy cigarettes for them. So it is something kind of rather strange. And it also raises the question of whether in other cases, where there are products that can cause harm to your body, whether similar legislation might be necessary. You know, for example, sugary food or salty food raises lots of interesting kind of public health and questions about personal freedom.
And of course, this government or this party has tried a sugar tax earlier on and had that rolled back. Kat, you wrote about this for us overnight. There's a very distinct political component in terms of people positioning themselves for the future of their party, isn't there?
Yes, I am somewhat sceptical as to how sincere the reservations are for the majority of MPs that either abstained or voted against this. There is definitely a libertarian wing to the Conservative Party, but it is by no means the strongest wing. And I think, well, I know from having spoken to some people about it who were planning to abstain, that the rationale for doing so was purely political. In some cases, it's a discipline thing and a dislike of Rishi Sunak. In other cases, it is a leadership jockeying. And of course, every likely leadership candidate also has MPs that are sort of rallying around them and supporting them. So already you have these different groups that are forming. And this is, I think, for the would-be leadership candidates of the perhaps very near future, a line in the sand that they will be able to point back to when the contest rises.
Christiana, what do you make of this from where you're sitting as a public health story and also the politics of it? Is it of interest in Costa Rica?
No, it has. We have many of other political knots that we're all tied up in, but I've been wondering how, in terms of personal liberty and personal choice, how is this different from the fact that you're not allowed to buy alcohol unless you are of a certain age, and the age is different from country to country.
Because at some point you will be able to be old enough to buy alcohol.
I see. Yes, that is a very important difference. So it seems to me that what they're trying to do, stepping away from the politics for a second, and I don't know if this word exists in English, but are they trying to denormalize? Does that exist in English, that word? Otherwise, we're just going to create it right here. Are they trying to denormalize smoking and see it for what it is? It really is a huge threat to health.
The small footnote I wanted to add, Giles, was that I think this isn't just a story about Conservative Party politics, as interesting as that is. I think there's also a kind of story about what's happening globally with drugs. I think it's really interesting that tobacco use has declined so much across the rich world that it's increasingly being restricted. But at the same time, the other trend that we're seeing is increasing shift towards decriminalization, legalization of cannabis. Even though there is significant evidence about the health impact of smoking cannabis, I think there are interesting shifts going on in terms of drug use.
Well, we'll see what happens to that proposal. As we say, it has passed a second reading, but it still has to ping pong backwards and forwards between the Lords and the Commons, because we have this crazy system with an unelected chamber that has a say.
It has to go through a few more stages before then, Charles.
Okay, so a lot more. We'll see. Thank you, Jeevan. Kat, tell us about your story.
So my story is a quite extraordinary Times investigation that has found that Mark Menzies, who is a long-standing MP, former minister, used thousands of pounds that was raised for donations in order to pay off private healthcare issues. But the nub of the story is actually this this interaction. He called a 78-year-old volunteer party activist at 3:15 in the morning to ask her to help him. He said he was locked in a flat and needed £5,000 as a matter of, quote, life or death. The sum was then increased to £6,500. And it ended up with the volunteer refused, but his office manager had to clear out her own ISA savings in order to pay this sum of money. It was then reimbursed by party funds, by donor funds. He told this woman that he had been locked up by bad people, which is where the bad people in my headline comes from. And the Conservative Party has known about this for 3 months and done nothing until yesterday, when this story was published the whip was removed. And there is now a question about what happens to Mark Menzies, whether he may be investigated by the Standards Commissioner, which could lead to him being suspended as an MP and trigger another by-election.
Kat, can I just interrupt? There's also a question. Is this a straightforward blackmail story? Do we know that yet?
So this is not the first time that Mark Menzies has been in trouble. So he was a minister in 2014 when it emerged that he had paid for a South American rent boy and he was forced to resign. Then this article kind of goes through in quite a lot of detail various other incidents involving alcohol, including the other part of my headline, which is a dog that appears to have got so drunk that it ended up having to have emergency work done by a vet, and a drunken incident at the last night of the Proms concert featuring Catherine Jenkins, in which he said to have got turned up intoxicated and got into a row with other patrons. When he realised that he did not have reserved VIP seats.
Was this... Are we talking about the dog still?
Yes, the dog was very annoyed about not having VIP seats. Zooming out a bit, I think this is the second story in a month involving a senior Conservative MP either being blackmailed or entrapped in some way, and in this case, having to seek money as a result of that. In the other case involving William Bragg, he gave out the contact details of people that he knew within Westminster as he was being blackmailed. And I think that, you know, this, we have to take this really seriously. Clearly, to my mind, and I should just say, Mark Menzies denies any wrongdoing on this, but the sort of various points that are being raised by this would point to someone that is at the very least troubled and in need of support. But we have to ask ourselves, why does this keep on happening? And is there a problem with our political system that enables people to come through it and are thrown into a situation that does not support them, but in fact exacerbates the problems. And, you know, someone once said to me, you know, if there's a flaw in your life, if you've got a drink problem or a marital problem, if there's any crack, being an MP will, Westminster will find that and wedge it further open. And I think that is the way to look at this. We need to understand MPs are human. If we want to have better politics, we need to have better politicians. And how can we support them to be that?
Okay, thanks, Kat. I will ask Jeevan your response to this in just a second. But first, Christiana, from where you're sitting, many time zones away, first of all, do you understand this story? And second of all, do you agree that there are serious political issues here? Or does it strike you as highly local?
You know, I have to say, Kat, I'm having a lot of trouble following. You know, it almost seems like a board game. Who, when, where, why, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the details of the story are really hard to follow. Where I completely agree with you, Kat, is yes, the pressures on not just MPs, but on all public figures. On all public figures. And that's the way it should be, honestly. If they're public figures, it's because they have made a choice that they want to stand and lead for the ideas and the principles and the actions and the legislations that they believe in, that they want to be role models for everyone else. I honestly will not buy the argument that poor politicians, there's so much pressure on them, and so they crack. I just don't buy that. I come from a very political family in Costa Rica. My father was president of the country 3 times. I have a brother who was president. I have a sister who was vice president, minister of state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I have grown up in that arena, in that environment. And I don't know, Pat. I don't know. I don't want to fall into the simplistic statement of we used to have serious and respectable politicians and we don't anymore. But there's a part of me that has that feeling. Whatever happened, and there I totally agree with you, whatever happened that being a political leader is no longer something that attracts the best and the brightest and the most devoted people. And it is attracting people that, as you have pointed out, that have all of these cracks. And the problem with that is that that then devolves into the public no longer trusting their political leaders because they have stories that are as hard to follow as the story that you have just given us. And therefore, credibility goes down to -40. So what is it? What is it that makes politics no longer the aspirational leadership area that we used to have? Am I, you know, so old that everything before now seems so much better than it is now? I'm beginning to listen to myself like my grandfather. It's not like it used to be, you know.
Jeevan, what do you make of this story?
I think that Kat and Christiana's conversation about kind of the political class is really interesting. I mean, I think I start from the same place as Christiana. I don't have much sympathy for the political class. This is, you know, these are people who are doing a serious job of running the country. They know what the stakes are. They know what the risks are. I think listening to Kat, I do think there might be an argument for saying we might need some reform. And the thought that crystallized in my head is perhaps we have too many MPs and perhaps they, you know, we should have fewer and they should be paid more. You know, it is odd to me, this guy that I've never heard of before, this sort of baffling scandal involving him coming a few weeks after another baffling scandal involving another MP that I've never heard of. Part of you wonders whether this tells us something about the class of person who wants to become an MP. I also wonder whether part of it is to do with a declining government and the class of person who becomes an MP at the end of a government's life cycle. And that perhaps is kind of closer to the heart of what's going on here.
Go for it, Kat.
Well, just on that, I think that the interesting thing about Mark Benzies is, as I said, that he was forced to resign as a minister 10 years ago. And he stayed as an MP. And there have been multiple elections since then. He could have stood down, or the electorate could have decided they didn't much like what he had done and voted him out, and they didn't. So I do agree that there is, at the tail end of the 14 years of Conservative government, there is this sense of sort of sleaze and the sort of end days of government, the dregs are sort of coming to the top. And but for this story, it could have been curtailed much earlier on. This is actually a story that was seeded in the sort of fairly early stages of the Conservative government.
It could have been curtailed by better party management, by his superiors.
Or by the electorate beating him out.
Or by public opinion, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have no expectation that our political leaders should live up to minimum standards. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and the election was only a year after that incident happened. So you'd have thought that memories were pretty clear.
I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea that in an ideal world, politicians, because they have chosen public service, should be afforded a measure of respect. But they have to earn it too. I mean, this is beyond parody.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You agree it's beyond parody? Well, it's certainly a heck of a story by my former colleague, Billy Kemba, at the Times, being followed by everyone. It'd be really interesting to see if it travels internationally. Before we move on, I feel the need, because it's printed in front of me, to read these denials out. In a statement to the Times, Mark Menzies said, "I strongly dispute the allegations put to me. I have fully complied with all the rules for declarations as there is an investigation ongoing. I will not be commenting further." And a spokesperson for the Conservative Party said, "The party takes all allegations seriously and we will always investigate any matters put to them." Thank you, Kat. It is a heck of a story. It'll have legs at least here. Thanks for that. We'll take a break and then we'll hear what Christiana thinks should lead the news.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. UK business leaders are quietly confident that better times are coming. More than half of those who responded to the recent EY CEO Outlook survey believe their profitability would increase in 2024. As businesses look to the future, transformation is clearly front and centre on the 2024 CEO agenda, with the vast majority of leaders planning to maintain or accelerate their transformational change in 2024. With 76% of CEOs in agreement that AI will deliver transformative efficiency benefits to their organization, how can AI be put to use to enhance innovation efforts? Find out how integrating AI into your business could minimize the negative impacts on the workforce, boost productivity, and improve overall employee experience by reading the full report at ey.com.
Okay, Christiana, tell us about your story.
Okay, so my headline is, as I said it right at the beginning, Giles, climate change comes home to bite in the UAE, in the United Arab Emirates. And that is because on Tuesday, there was total chaos in Dubai after the country endured the heaviest rainfall they have ever seen in 75 years. The effects of this sudden, intense rainfall is flash flooding across the city that uprooted trees, stopped traffic, shattered building facades, closed the airport, closed schools. And it wasn't just in Dubai or in the UAE. The flooding actually impacted large areas across the other Gulf states, such as Bahrain and Oman. the reason why I think it's important to look at this is, what caused this rain? It's not just because it rained. What caused the rain? First, reports came out to say that it had to do with cloud seeding, which the Emirates have been doing for a while. But actually, it has been shown that that had nothing to do with this rain. It's actually likely, and I say likely because it hasn't come out yet, it's likely the impact of climate change. Now, that actually, I think, is the story. Because just 10 years ago, it was still very, very difficult to know how deeply extreme weather events such as this for the area and they're in were either caused or magnified by climate change. But now we do know, because now we have an organization called the World Weather Attribution Group. And they use weather observations and climate models to understand how climate influences both the intensity, the frequency, and the likelihood of these extreme weather events. And the science of attribution is advancing very rapidly. So we don't know yet, because this just happened on Tuesday, but I think we can expect the World Weather Attribution Group to go in and take a look, just like they did last week with the heat waves in the Sahel, to go in, take a look, and tell us whether this was had to do with extreme, this weather had to do with climate change. If it is shown that this extreme rain has to do with climate change, it's going to be very sobering for the UAE and for its neighbors. Let's remember that the Gulf region at large is the second largest producer of fossil fuels in the world. And it is the burning of these fossil fuels which are the main cause of climate change. Now, if you have been there, and even if you haven't, you will know that the Gulf region is already one of the hottest in the world, Charles. And so in the face of rising global temperatures everywhere, but there also, they have been moving their daily living inside and underground and increasing their dependence on air conditioning. But they are not prepared for rain. They are absolutely not prepared for the infrastructure and the human impacts of rain. So this has caught them by surprise and is very, very sobering for them when they look forward into, do we want to continue to produce and export fossil fuels?
Given their dependence on fossil fuels, and given the fact that they know as well as the rest of us do that actually a global fight back against climate change requires much bigger economic blocks than the UAE to act, you say it's sobering, but do you think it'll actually have an effect on policy in the UAE?
Well, it remains to be seen, but I think it has to be said that the UAE, of all of the Gulf countries, is probably the one that is most aware of climate on their capacity to survive where they are. And they have been taking pretty impressive steps into not just installing and using renewable energy, but actually investing into finessing solar panel technologies. And that because they know that this is not, yes, that is their one main income right now, not just for them, but certainly for Saudi Arabia and the rest of them. But they know that that is not an eternal and an unlimited sale ticket. They know that there is going to come a point in which they will not be able to sell anymore. So they're starting the transition. So to your question, it won't completely change the transition. It won't ignite the transition. Could it actually accelerate the transition? Maybe.
Okay. Jeevan, what's your reaction to the story? And also pick up, if you want, on the business about attribution and Christiana's point about that science, that branch of climate science gaining respectability, if you will.
Charles, I think this is an incredibly compelling story. I think one of the things that I would point out is that, as Christiana knows, there were other weather-related disasters this week. So she mentioned the Sahel, but there's also Kazakhstan, where there's severe flooding, and they've declared a national disaster. I think it's really interesting that Dubai has caught our attention. I think that's happened because it's a wealthy country, because it's a hub, because it's a country that we've all heard of, and hardly any of us are aware of what's happening in some of these other regions. I do think it matters, actually. I think Christian is right to sort of point to what's happening in Dubai. I think it matters if it happens in a rich country, because I think that has the potential to galvanize action in other rich countries, because it's easier for us to identify, easier for us to think, this could happen to us. This is a place I've been to. This is a place where I stopped on the way to wherever I was going. I think one thing that I would sort of maybe add to what Christiana said is that I think that it is probably the case that climate change has amplified this disaster. But what really matters, I think, in the way that countries respond right now, obviously it matters to bring down emissions. It obviously matters to transition faster to cleaner energy. But we also have to think about adaptation. I think it's really noteworthy to ask where the water governance was in Dubai. Why did the airport get flooded? Why did we see these really dramatic scenes? And one potential answer here is that a lot of the infrastructure that has been built in a lot of countries around the world is too hard, is too rigid to cope with the increased flows of stormwater that we're seeing due to climate change, and that our cities really need to be softer and greener and spongier if they're going to cope with these kinds of impacts.
I wonder if with a lot more rain, they might become spongier naturally.
No. The key point, Giles, is to slow the flow of stormwater. So if you have an increased flow of water and you just have it running through very hard surfaces, that leads to scenes like the ones we saw this week. Whereas if you build gardens like you see in Singapore, then you slow it down and you don't have these impacts.
The infrastructure that we have up until now, everywhere in these countries, but everywhere, has been built for a stable climate, one that says, okay, we're going to build for this type of environmental context, without taking into account that just doesn't exist anymore. There is no such thing as a stable environmental context. We're in the throes of very rapid change, and that change is actually accelerating to be exponential as we speak. And so it is understandable that Dubai can't deal with rain, because they got basically more rain in 12 hours than they do in an entire year. Now, if it's spaced over an entire year, they can deal with it. If it comes in 12 hours, they can't deal with it. And that is not just in Dubai. That is everywhere. All our infrastructure has been built for status, for a business as usual environmental context, and that just does not exist anymore. So when Jimin is talking about adaptation, yes, it's adaptation of human beings. How are we going to adapt as all living beings? It's also adaptation of infrastructure.
Point well taken. Kat, have you seen this? What do you make of it?
Yes, I am that person that only pays attention to places that I've heard of or been to, because I heard it in relation to Dubai Airport being closed, which is the way that it's being presented in the UK media, because a lot of people use Dubai as a sort of, you know, cross off point when they're travelling further on. And I think the point about adaptation is interesting. Also, kind of thinking back to the really hot summer that we had in the UK a couple of years ago, when the trains were effectively unable to work because the train tracks were kind of expanding in the heat. And, you know, our infrastructure in the UK, I mean, we have very changeable weather here, but we don't have extreme weather. And we're not very good when the, you know, kind of gets anything beyond a little bit wet or a little bit cold or a little bit warm. We, you know, we just can't deal with it. Whereas, you know, we have snow kind of most years that the Canadians would sort of sniff at. And yet it kind of causes all sorts of havoc. So on adaptation, I think it's really important. And the sort of, you know, the need for all countries to invest in sort of new technologies that are able to.
Or old technologies like verandas and gardens.
Or old technologies.
And grass.
And grass. Yeah. Christiana, and you kind of skated over the cloud seeding point. As someone who's a bit of a novice to these things, could you explain what it is and why you're able to discount it so quickly?
Well, I was not able to understand. It was discounted by quite a few scientists because of the timing. The UAE, in fact, the whole Gulf region has a very difficult time with having any water whatsoever. They don't have fresh water. Basically, they have to desalinate most of the water that they use for either drinking water or for agricultural purposes, the little agriculture that they have. And so they have come into the habit of, yes, desalinating water, but also doing some cloud seeding, which is a pretty nascent technology, which is basically a technology that accelerates the descent, if you will, of moisture in the air. And that's why it's called cloud seeding, because it accelerates the droplets of water that are being held up in clouds or up in the air, and it helps them to drop, to get some moisture. But this was not a case of that. They use that just to, you know, keep some moisture in the air. It's a nascent technology. They probably are one of the best in the world in using it, and it may be used by many other countries in the future. But the point is that this had nothing to do with their cloud seeding because of the timing of the cloud seeding that they had. This has nothing to do. So I really want to underline the World Weather Attribution Group has not come out yet to say this was due to climate change, or at least it was intensified by climate change. I would expect that they might come out, I don't know, next week perhaps. They already came out about the heat wave in Sahel. They came out pretty clearly. If I were them, I would not let this one go by without coming out on a statement, just because it's so emblematic.
Thank you so much, Christiana. Go ahead, Jeevan.
Charles, I think to Kat's point, I think the discounting of cloud seeding was partly to do with the timing, but partly also to do with the location of where the UAE does its cloud seeding, which doesn't seem to have been in the same location as these rains, but also to do with the scale. I don't think that it's technically possible for us to achieve rain on this scale. So, you know, as astonishing as humans are, we aren't quite able to do that.
I think we need some sun seeding in the UK.
Sun seeding.
Essentially, what Beijing tried to use cloud seeding for before the 2008 Olympics was to seed the clouds, get the rain out of them so that it was clear skies for the opening ceremony. But Walt Disney did try to seed the clouds to get snow to fall on the Squaw Valley 1960 Olympics with cannons that fired silver iodide up into the atmosphere. It didn't really work. They did get snow in the end, but only because nature provided it. Okay, those are the stories. The smoking ban, the strange case of MM, as I put in, Mark Menzies, and Deluge in Dubai. This is the point where you have to choose one, but you can't choose your own. So Jeevan, you go first.
I think for me, it's obviously the Dubai story. And I think the reason that I would vote for it is because I think climate change is often this sort of very diffuse story, global story that we're all involved in without clear locations, a clear focus. And this gives us a really, really clear focus on a place that everyone in the world has heard of.
Kat.
Yes, I agree. As you probably know, I have a sort of slight aversion to climate change stories because I find them so overwhelming and terrifying and yet sort of quite slow moving. But I think that this really narrows it down, and that the sort of irony of, as Christiana set out, it happening in the region that is the produces the second largest amount of fossil fuels, I think really kind of draws it all together. So Christiana's story gets my vote.
And Christiana, I'm afraid you can't choose your own. You have to choose one of the others for the top of the bulletin.
Okay, well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to choose Jihan's because I'm still struggling to understand Kat's story. And I also think, it is actually very compelling that it is such a complicated story with, you know, cats and dogs put in there. It's really very concerning that that is the status of politics in one of the major industrialized countries in the world. Jihan, and I would choose your story on smoking ban because it does raise very interesting questions about individual choice, about health, about the responsibility. Interestingly enough, the responsibility of politicians. Is this actually an antidotal story to cats, because now we have politicians who are actually acting like statesmen and seeing the long-term consequences of something that they might do, can we be generous enough to give the Prime Minister some credit for being a responsible politician, at least on this? Kat is not with me, but I'm trying. I'm really trying here.
I think that's a very brave effort. Well, look, now I have to say what I think. I'm going to rank them as follows. In third place, the smoking ban, because it hasn't happened yet. Even though I accept all the arguments about the political interest therein and the public health arguments for one, I'm ranking the strange case of Mark Menzies second, because I think the quality of democratic leadership is a critical issue right now when tyrants across the world are looking at the democratic world as weak, incapable of finding and promoting the smartest, bravest, most honest talents. And that is an existential issue for all of us who live in free societies and hope that they will remain free. It won't surprise any of my colleagues, either of my colleagues, that I have chosen Christiana's story about the deluge in Dubai to lead the news, for precisely the reasons that it is almost certain to be attributed to climate change. And as Jeevan said, it focuses an all too often diffuse story on a few spectacular scenes from somewhere that everybody's heard of, even if they haven't been to it before. So that's it for this episode of The News Meeting. If you think there's a story we missed, you can email us on newsmeeting@tortoisemedia.com. Jeevan, thank you so much. Christiana, especially for dialing in from Costa Rica, thanks so much for being with us. And Kat, you're going to be joining me next Wednesday for another recording of The News Meeting Live, when we're also going to be joined by the journalist and broadcaster David Aronovich and by your Uber rival News Meeting regular Jess Winch. To be in the audience, go to tortoisemedia.com/book. That's tortoisemedia.com/book. We'll be back with another episode on Monday, and I leave you with the latest postcard from America sent to us by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists, the husband and wife team of Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan.
College sports are huge in America. A friend of ours was in London recently, and someone there claimed that Americans don't have a fierce sports rivalry like Arsenal-Tottenham or Liverpool-Man United. And she told him, "We call that Ohio State-Michigan."
You know, the rivalry between Ohio State University and Michigan University is massive, and I know because I'm from Ohio. So our postcard this week is about the rise of college women's basketball, fueled by one charismatic star.
Martin, the rebound for Iowa. Here is Clark flicking it ahead. Stolke turns.
Women's college basketball is smashing all kinds of audience records in the United States. The championship game last week drew more fans than baseball's World Series and the venerable Masters Golf Tournament. Its viewership topped men's college and pro ball. We were among the nearly 19 million people captivated by the roller coaster game between the University of Iowa and the University of South Carolina. It was the first women's basketball game that we had ever watched from the tip-off to the final buzzer. And like many others, we caught this new fever because of 22-year-old Caitlin Clark from Iowa. She's the highest-scoring player, male or female, in Division I college basketball history. Last month, she broke an all-time career-scoring record that had stood since 1970. Clark has magic. She consistently makes impossible shots, arcing a 9.5-inch wide ball into an 18-inch hoop from as far away as 35 feet. "She's breathtaking to watch," said Christine Brennan, a well-known sports columnist and TV commentator. Brennan compared Clark to the diva at the opera or the star in the Broadway hit. "You can't take your eyes off her," she said. On the court, Clark's athleticism over a two-hour game causes jaws to drop and fans to stand. On off the court, she comes across as confident and composed, not a hothead or a show-off.
People aren't going to remember every single win or every single loss.
This is Clark speaking after her team lost to the reigning national champions, South Carolina.
I think they're just going to, you know, remember the moments that they shared at one of our games or watching on TV or, you know, how excited their young daughter or son got about, you know, watching women's basketball. I think that's pretty cool. And that's, you know, those are the things that mean the most to me when people come up to me.
Clark wears her long brown hair tied up in a ponytail, a thin headband keeping any stray hairs out of her line of vision. She is a no-fuss gal in a baggy uniform who doesn't wear makeup. The Caitlin Clark effect, as many sportcasters call it, comes 50 years after the enactment of Title IX, a law that forced colleges to invest as much in women's sports programs as men's. It aimed to give girls and young women equal opportunity. Until then, colleges poured money into first-class facilities and coaches for male athletes, while women barely were given the money for a locker room. Plenty of world-class female athletes have benefited from this law, and some have risen to stardom, especially in women's soccer. But until now, basketball, a game invented in America, has been thoroughly dominated by men. Just about everyone has heard of legends like LeBron James. But now Americans can name a female basketball star, Caitlin Clark, who was the top pick in this week's Women's National Basketball Association draft, and is expected to compete in the U.S. Olympic team this summer.
You better bring it every single night, and I think that's exactly what I'm going to do, but I think that's exactly how I lived my college career, too, is like every single game, no matter what the opponent was, I prepped the exact same way, I prepared the same way, I brought the same fire, I brought the same energy, and I think that's the biggest thing going into my WNBA career.
As with so many things in America, the Clark phenomenon has raised racial questions. She is white, and many have asked, would there be so much buzz if she were black? Some say no. So many basketball stars, both men and women, are black that she stands out. But South Carolina coach Dawn Staley, who is black, had nothing but praise for Clark after the championship game.
I want to personally thank Caitlin Clark for lifting up our sport. She carried a heavy load for our sport. And it just is not going to stop here on the collegiate tour. But when she is the number one pick in the WNBA draft, she's gonna lift that league up as well. So Caitlin Clark, if you're out there, you are one of the GOATs of our games. We appreciate you.
The big bucks are still in men's basketball. The WNBA's annual revenue is about $200 million compared to the NBA's $10 billion. Even though ticket sales for women's games have jumped 200%, men still dominate dollars. It's also unclear if the current obsession will last. When Clark goes pro, and if there is no new college dynamo, will the interest run out as fast as the game's 24-second shot clock? The lucrative sports betting industry hopes not. Suddenly, it got a new boost from women's basketball. Several sports books said the championship game was the most bet women's sporting event ever, of any kind. The big test may be in how many young girls start playing. And if the women who had become Clark fans stay tuned, our daughter, Kate, a 29-year-old CNN journalist who had been captain of her high school volleyball team, has been following Clark intently, thrilled by the nation's fixation on a young female athlete. Kate was bummed when Clark's team lost the championship game. But the next day, she dug out her basketball from a box in the garage and went to a neighborhood park and started shooting hoops.
That's it from us. We'll have another postcard for you in a couple of weeks. Speak to you again soon.
Tortoise.
I'm David Baddiel. I'm a writer and a comedian and a Jew.
I'm Saida Varsi. I'm a businesswoman and a politician and a Muslim.
Jews and Muslims always seem to be in the news or on the news. Lots of people talk about us, and this is us talking about ourselves.
The kind of things that people say don't touch, yeah. We are going to go there.
I mean, I think Jews and Muslims are talking about these things, but I think they're not talking about them together because they're worried that if they do, sparks might fly. A Muslim and a Jew go there.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts.